Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
The people paying the highest price for all of this in Iraq are first the Iraqi people, of course. Second would be members of the U.S. military. And then third, the U.S. taxpayers.
Journalist Dar Jamil joins us for the half hour to discuss an increase in violence in Iraq once again. 35 bombings in Baghdad alone during the month of April by April 27th, the day we phoned Dar Jamil. Hundreds of civilians have been killed, hundreds more wounded, and no end in sight. Does this mean the Obama administration will change withdrawal plans? And could the al-Maliki government survive without the U.S. occupation to prop it up? We'll discuss these questions and more with Dar Jamil. He is author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. His new book is Military Resistors, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq, another Haymarket book due out shortly. You can read Dar's reports at dar.org. That's dahr.org. Dar, welcome.
Thank you, Dori. Good to be with you.
Once again, your articles are full of reports of violence, and I'd like to start with maybe the middle of April and just have you kind of walk us through how things have unfolded and how Iraq now all of a sudden is fraught with these violent attacks, you know, day to day.
I've been watching the story unfold very closely because it's been very predictable. And we actually, for context, need to go back to the U.S. forming the what were commonly referred to for a long time as awakening groups or awakening councils. This was basically an attempt for the U.S. military to draw down attacks against themselves, as well as to try to get some control over al-Qaeda, which was operating in Iraq at the time at very high levels. And so they created what are now referred to as the Sahwa, or Sons of Iraq, which is a 100,000-strong Sunni militia. They were all on the U.S. payroll. Most of them were admitted former resistance fighters. Many of them were even al-Qaeda members themselves, according to the U.S. military. But the plan worked. It did put a cap on attacks. They were able to either pay off al-Qaeda or go after those who weren't able to be paid off. And we saw a dramatic decrease in violence, both against the Iraqi people and the U.S. military. The problems then started also simultaneously with the formation of this force, which was opposed to vehemently by the Maliki government. Even while Bush was in the office of presidency, we saw Maliki fighting this policy from the very start because he felt that this militia was a threat to his authority and of his government in Baghdad. We saw his government then and their security apparatus going after the awakening forces from the very beginning. They were targeting their leadership, detaining fighters when they could get their hands on them, and other methods. Well, then as of this past October, the U.S. military stopped being in direct control of the Sahwa, as they were supposed to be rolled over into the government security apparatus. It was promised by Maliki that 20% of the Sahwa would be given security jobs in the government, like with the police or the army, and then the remainder would be given civilian jobs. Well, to date, less than 20% of the total Sahwa have been given either government jobs as security workers or in civilian positions. And then those who have been given jobs are being paid substantially less than their counterparts who are already in those same jobs. So we've seen actually Sahwa members to this date who have been working security in Baghdad. And I talked with some of these folks when I was in there this past February. They hadn't been paid since the Americans stopped paying them in October. The commanders I spoke with were deeply disconcerted, saying, look, this can't continue. If this continues, we're going to have people quitting. That's not going to help security. People are going to quit going after al-Qaeda. And also, we're going to see a rise in attacks. And even some of these people are so angry because they're being targeted by government forces that they might resume their resistance attacks as they had done so in the past. And I've been watching this, and I started seeing this happen in early April, and then bigger and bigger outbreaks of violence happening as a result. So by mid-April, we saw Sahwa forces starting to come into direct clashes with both American forces and Iraqi forces. And then also, so many of them had been walking off their security posts that we started to see an increase in al-Qaeda attacks. And this last week so far has been, I think, the biggest example we have of both of these trends starting to really hit levels that we haven't seen in Iraq of violence in over a year and a half. Last week, Thursday, was the bloodiest day in Iraq we've had in over a year's time. And the disconcerting part about this story, in addition to how bloody last week was, is that I don't see anything that's going to change the situation for the better happening anytime soon. I do not see Maliki making any kind of gestures towards the Sawa that, okay, we're going to have some reconciliation, we're going to start paying you guys, we're going to give the rest of you jobs as promised. I don't see anything like that happening in the Baghdad government side, nor do I see anything happening in the Obama administration that indicates they would pressure Maliki to push for reconciliation, to roll some of these people into the security forces and put them back to work and doing their job, which they were actually relatively successful at doing. And so I do expect to see what happened last week, maybe not quite at that level, but I do expect to see this continuing to unravel.
And in the past few days, we've seen Nouri al-Maliki demand arrests, ask for an investigation after a U.S. military home raid resulted in the death of a woman. What has he really done overall, though, to reverse some of the negative consequences of the surge? You documented this in the past few articles that you've written, how the surge contributed or solidified the Balkanization of Iraq, separation between Shiite and Sunni.
I don't see him doing anything to bridge the reconciliation gap that continues to be a huge problem in Iraq. In fact, I see him so far engaged in policies that are only going to widen that gap. But the instance you mentioned just about 2 days ago, our time, down in Kut, the U.S. military conducted a raid in a house and they killed a man and a woman. The woman happened to be the wife of a local Klan leader. The funeral procession turned into a very large, angry demonstration against the U.S. And Maliki, politically, the political context for this, which is important to understand when you look at why he came out with such angry remarks that, well, the U.S. military didn't have authorization to do this, and we are going to pressure them to give us over the people responsible for these deaths so we can try them in Iraqi courts. Anyone who's followed Iraq for 5 minutes knows this is absolute hogwash. Maliki has no jurisdiction to do this. The U.S. military wouldn't stand for that for 1 second. Maliki's basically pretending as though Iraq really has sovereignty and conveniently overlooking the fact that it's occupied by over 130,000 U.S. forces and that his government, which is located inside the Green Zone, basically doesn't exist without this occupation. So it's basically fat chance that he would ever get the opportunity to try a U.S. soldier in Iraqi court. It's just not going to happen. But he's forced politically into this position of coming off as being the staunch defender of the Iraqi people, and he'll stand up to the occupation forces when an incident like this happens because his entire legitimacy depends on it. He rode into the success he had in the January provincial elections of his maintaining power as prime minister and actually getting more power because of the security situation, because he effectively portrayed himself as the bringer of security to Iraq, that since he's been prime minister, that he was able to bring security under control. That's coming unraveled. That's a direct threat to his position of power and legitimacy as prime minister. And so anytime something like this, what happened in Kut, surfaces, then he has to take as strong a stance as possible to try to capitalize on it and portray himself in that light of kind of the protector of Iraq. And I think that he's going to be faced with many, many more opportunities like this, because particularly in the South, where, you know, we have the Brits are pulling out, they're having less of a presence on the streets, and this is being taken up by the U.S. forces as this trend continues. So I think we'll see more and more instances like this that are going to make it much more challenging for Maliki.
And you have said yourself in this story that you wrote for Truthout April 24th that the bombings reek of al-Qaeda in Iraq and that their operations had been brought to a standstill because of the Iraqi resistance and the al-Sawa and their compromise, really, with the U.S. Now that's all been abandoned by the U.S. military. Can you just give us a sense of the more successful strategy? I mean, in the context of the surge overall, what was the success? Was it just the fact that they were starting to pay members of the Sunni militia? I think it was $300 a month or $300 a week. I don't remember.
It was $300 a month, that's right. What we're talking about is a Band-Aid, and it was an effective Band-Aid, but it was a Band-Aid. The U.S. basically, under the Bush administration, effectively paid off the resistance to stand down and not attack Americans. They gave them money, they gave them uniforms, they created official positions in Iraqi security forces in the towns and neighborhoods where they operated, mostly in certain parts of Baghdad and then particularly around Al-Anbar province, which, as we all remember, has basically been the seat of resistance in Iraq. And those who didn't join the SAWA were targeted or forced to go underground, and it basically worked. And the other aspect of it is that the military was reporting as far back as 2005, even late 2004, on red-on-red fighting, which means enemy-on-enemy fighting, which to them means Iraqi resistance going after al-Qaeda. So they knew then that the resistance was already fighting al-Qaeda. The Iraqi resistance did not want al-Qaeda operating in their country and were actually quite effective. Obviously, since Iraqis know in their own country, they were very effective at finding the al-Qaeda element and rooting them out and killing them. So the U.S. saw this and said, okay, well, let's basically put these guys on the payroll. That way they'll stop attacking us, and then we can help them in that way to support them in their fight against al-Qaeda, and that will bring violence down. This will make things look a little bit better for 2008 and hopefully help McCain come into office. That was the whole political strategy behind that. And the Band-Aid worked. It was very effective for a time. They removed the Band-Aid in October, and the trends continued for a while because it did look as though the Maliki government was going to roll at least some of these guys in to the promised positions. They did that for a couple of months up until the November elections here in the U.S. and then basically abandoned it nearly completely. And so we have a situation now where the Band-Aid has been removed, and again, we're seeing al-Qaeda level attacks on a level that we hadn't seen in about a year and a half. And I think things are going to continue along these lines because the military, rather than trying to reassert themselves to align themselves with the SAWA, put them back on the payroll or something like this, are continuing to distance themselves from them, as well as actually having open clashes with them in certain parts of Iraq.
Let's turn to some of the political implications here. As we listen to a short clip of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, she visited Iraq April 25th, telling press security is still better. But this is her answer to ABC News when asked if the increase in violence might alter U.S. plans for a pullout by August 2010.
In the absence of any decision on the part of the Iraqi government, we are in an agreement with them that we are going to draw down.
Dar, you've seen a lot of war propaganda over the years, now various factions once again struggling for power in Iraq. What do you see as some of the motivations for the renewed violence, if you can pin any down?
As far as what's the political motivation for al-Qaeda to be launching these attacks right now, this is basically a group with a completely insane ideology to basically just kill as many Shia as possible to purify their brand of Islam, so only basically this radical Sunni fundamentalist Islam exists in the world, and it's just complete lunacy. But I won't really even try to pretend to guess what their main goal is beyond that insane ideology. But when we look at the broader political context of the violence in Iraq today, it certainly serves the U.S. agenda to maintain forces in Iraq when we have violence and chaos and sectarian strife going on there. Hillary Clinton now coming in, and the sole purpose of this trip to Baghdad was to reassure Maliki and his government that the U.S. is not going to abandon them, i.e. that we will maintain forces in cities even beyond the June 30 deadline. And that's actually coming out right now today as we speak. We see news articles coming out. Okay, well, in Mosul, as General Odierno had said, trouble spots like Mosul, the U.S. military will not be withdrawing from those cities. So that basically gives them the gray area they need to subvert the status of forces agreement to maintain a presence in cities like Mosul or anywhere else violence is going to break out, whether it be in parts of Baghdad. I mean, the U.S. military talks about we're going to pull out of cities, yet at Camp Victory, which is at the airport base in Baghdad, they have over 20,000 soldiers, and that's basically in Baghdad. That's right on the outskirts of the city. We have Camp Falcon in South Baghdad, 5,000 troops. So much for pulling out of the cities. I mean, it's a bit of a wash. But I think, again, getting back to the broader political context, when we have violence back up to the level it is right now in Iraq, it makes it that much easier for this administration or any other administration in the future to justify a continuance of the occupation. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now.
It's a story we've heard before, right? I mean, and especially during some of the years that you yourself were in Iraq covering the war and reporting on the thousands of home raids that were going on then and how the Iraqis were becoming enraged. Fallujah, the attacks there, just causing a huge growth in support for the resistance. How do you think the civilian population in Iraq are going to be making choices? Because on the one hand, they've got the U.S., an occupying force still, and a force that has not engaged in the kind of reconstruction that would have given them a better quality of life. Al-Maliki very much in the pocket of one leader in the United States after the next. And then various forces competing really for land, power, money, and oil rights. It seems like the Iraqi people have become a little bit more irrelevant than anything else.
Right. And as time goes on in the occupation, that becomes increasingly so, where they become more and more disenfranchised by the day. I think last time we talked, Dori, I really went into the specifics of, for example, how much worse daily life is now for the Iraqi people. And as various factions of political groups in Iraq continue to vie for position and make deals with Western contractors and Western governments like the U.S. government specifically, the Iraqi people get left further and further out in the cold. So there's even less electricity. The economy is in even worse shape. The medical system is deteriorating even further. Once again, violence is on the uptick. And again, you know, the people paying the highest price for all of this in Iraq are first the Iraqi people, of course. Second would be members of the U.S. military. And then third, the U.S. taxpayers who are funding this entire operation to a tune of over $720 million every single day.
Is the Obama administration caught now behind the eight ball where the U.S. military operation is concerned, or do you see the White House as really in control? I know you have been writing, too, about the budget that was handed to the military for the Iraq operation. And you've also talked about the various messages, perhaps, that the military operation itself might have gotten from the Obama team.
You know, when we look at the reception that President Obama received in Baghdad when he was there and he gave the talk at Baghdad Airport, and let us remember, he did not leave the airport. The troops were extremely excited there to see them. We didn't have the typical kind of stage-managed press conference that Bush would hold where troops were basically ordered to stand behind him and hold and wave little American flags and smile and clap on cue. I mean, these, by contrast, the troops at Obama's seemed genuinely happy that he was there. People were screaming out, "We love you," and I think the majority of them there, at least in that gathering, really believed, you know, that they were going to be withdrawn, that Obama was bringing things in that direction. But I think that time will change that. I think that especially when we see things developing on the ground that are going to justify a slowing down of the withdrawal of American forces. That's now the current rhetoric coming out of the Obama administration and particularly the Department of Defense and the Pentagon, where they're saying, look, you know, we are going to have the majority of the troops withdrawn by the end of 2010. We are going to start withdrawing them right now this year. And while a very, very small number have actually been withdrawn, I think it's still under 2,000, we are not looking at any further scheduled withdrawals until the end of this year. So they're already starting to push it back. And, you know, Dori, you were the first person I ever did a radio interview with in my time in Iraq. And I remember it was in December 2003. And I remember between that time and now, I don't know how many interviews we've done, but how many instances have we seen that we can remember just off the top of our heads where promises are made, the bright and shining rhetoric is put out there, and then comes the gray area in the weeks that follow. Well, then this general will step up and say, well, yes, this was said, but until we have this complete, we really can't actually withdraw from the cities, or until this problem is resolved. I know we said this, but we can't actually follow through on this promise. I mean, how many corners have we turned? how many changes have been promised and then not followed up on. And this is just kind of a continuance of that same policy where let's make these bright and shining promises and then let's rely on people's attention deficit disorder to be distracted by things like the economy or swine flu or Britney Spears or what have you, while we basically continue forward with the exact same policy in Iraq. And we are seeing that happen right now, where there is no real withdrawal happening. There's nothing on the ground to indicate that the U.S. is going to do much the rest of this year beyond maybe pulling out of some of the cities into their bases and stay put. But, of course, in the meantime, these bases are not only being not deconstructed or disassembled, but they're actually being augmented and expanded, hence the so-called embassy in the middle of the green zone, as just one example.
Now, what about possible regional and political implications for some of these events in Iraq? You reported April 24th in Truthout on a major suicide bombing, Shiite Iranian pilgrims in a restaurant targeted, 45 killed, 60 wounded. And right now we're hearing comments from Israel again about the perception of the new leaders there, too, that Iran should be attacked.
I actually don't think that attacks on Iranian pilgrims in Iraq, and I actually was just on a press TV show out of Tehran, Iran, earlier this morning, and they asked basically the same question, you know, what does this have to do in the regional political scheme of Israel, Iran? Will Israel attack Iran? Is there anything joining the attacks on Iranian pilgrims in Iraq to this kind of bellicose rhetoric from Israel to against Iran, et cetera? And I really don't think so. I think that that's just simply not the case. I mean, as I said before, this is a product of the insane ideology of al-Qaeda, which basically believes that the world must be purged of people who adhere to the Shia Muslim faith, as opposed to a radical Wahhabi Sunni extremist version of Islam, which is total lunacy. That said, you know, one thing that has happened in Iraq that we could draw direct parallels to Israel's influence on the U.S. government, which is deep and extremely powerful, and how that influence affects U.S. policy in Iraq, is the U.S. has been engaged for quite some time now in going after what they call special groups, which they believe are Iranian-backed fighters in Iraq that are targeting occupation forces or carrying out other types of destabilizing efforts. And so we've seen, actually, just in the last couple of weeks, hundreds of people being detained across southern Iraq in places like Kut, and I think that may well have been what was behind this raid that we discussed earlier, but in places like Kut, in Amara, in Basra, in Nasiriyah, and other cities around the south, where literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people are being detained. They're being brought into Camp Buka and other U.S. detention facilities down there, and they're being accused of either being Iranian or collaborating with the Iranians to carry out operations in Iraq. And I think that actually would speak directly as an example of what you're talking about.
There are also attacks on police. And I want to ask you about the strength of the Iraqi military or police. They seem to be dying now. And we saw this a few years ago where they were, in the military lingo, soft targets. Can you just discuss who the fighting is really engaging in all of this? Because we have not been seeing a lot of U.S. military deaths.
That's true, and you're right in that assumption, and that for a long time now, and I think this has been part of the U.S. plan, where back in late 2004, early 2005, someone in the military pretty high up stated, we're going to put an Iraqi face on this occupation. And they've been actually quite effective at doing that, and that's why we have now well over 500,000 Iraqi police and army. Actually, I think the total is now over 700,000 members of a combined Iraqi army and police. I mean, this is a massive number of security personnel. I mean, that's almost one out of every 27 Iraqis being either a policeman or in the military. I mean, this has been a U.S. effort to basically create a police state there to try to dampen down the violence, and they've basically used these security personnel as a buffer. They've put them in between themselves and any attacks that are going to happen. And this is why the U.S. removed all their checkpoints from Baghdad, and they were replaced by Iraqi police and Iraqi military. It's why they are trying to pull back into their bases. And I think it is actually the primary reason why there's been such a dramatic decrease in U.S. military fatalities. Although that said, we have to point out that in the last 5 days, we've had an American soldier killed every single day.
Dar, just give us a kind of weather report about Iraq this summer, what you expect to see.
I would expect to see kind of a continuation of what we've been seeing over the last month, which is big flashes of extreme violence, as we saw this last week, and then it falls back down to kind of the moderate, slow burn, ongoing violence that we've been seeing over the last couple of months. But over the last 2 months, there's been a consistent increase in overall violence in Iraq, which last week was basically an extreme example of that. But I would expect to see this continue because, as I said before, I don't see any gestures from the Maliki government of stopping their policies of targeting the SAWA and not paying them and kind of leaving them out in the cold. I don't see anything happening in the U.S. administration or the military to try to step in and pressure the Maliki government to behave any differently. Simultaneously, I think we will see the U.S. pull out of some of the cities as of the end of June 30, but anywhere where there's any kind of problem or violence whatsoever, I would not expect to see any change in U.S. policy in any of those cities, particularly around parts of Baghdad. So I would expect to see a continuing of the violence, a continuing of some of these spectacular attacks as we saw last week, growing problems and growing clashes between the SAWA and Iraqi government forces, and then probably even a continued slight increase of resistance attacks against the U.S. military as more and more members of the SAWA decide, look, you know, we were sold out and we're not going to play this game anymore. We're going to go back to our former jobs, which was basically attacking the U.S. military, for which they're paid also, but from different sources, of course. So I think, unfortunately, a very brutal and much more violent summer in Iraq, especially as compared to last summer.
Can the United States just pull out at this point? What would that do to the Shiite rulers of Iraq today? How would they deal with then al-Qaeda in Iraq and what might happen in that kind of scenario?
Well, Iraq is an absolute disaster. It is a complete failed state. The occupation is the only thing propping up this occupation government. It's a Vichy government that only exists because the occupiers are there. It's located inside the Green Zone, which is controlled by the U.S. military. It does have an Iraqi face on it, but it is controlled by the U.S. military. And there are no easy solutions. Unfortunately, at this point, due primarily to U.S. policies, both under the Bush administration and in those being carried forward by the Obama administration, I think that still the only moral, rational, right thing to do is respect the wishes of the majority of people in the country of Iraq, of which over 71% favor a total withdrawal of all U.S. forces. And I think that's what has to happen, is to start not making plans, but start withdrawing forces and breaking down the bases immediately. Will this leave a power vacuum? Yes. Will there be ongoing violence in Iraq? Yes. But the reality is then Iraq would have true sovereignty, and there do exist groups and political coalitions right now that are on the fringe that don't have power because they're not supported by the Americans, that are calling for reconciliation and calling for a unified Iraq and calling for a real democratic government and real elections. And only until the occupation has ended will Iraqi coalitions such as that have a real chance to come into being and really represent the Iraqi people, of which their primary wish, as I said, is an end to the occupation. What country, what people in any country on the planet would prefer to be occupied as opposed to not being occupied? And the Iraqi people have suffered so much so far that they are willing to take whatever risk is necessary to not be occupied, because they know that's really the only real first step towards reconstruction and reconciliation in their country.
Dar Jamail, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dory.
Dar Jamail is author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, the book written about his 8 months in Iraq, covering the war during 2003 and 2004. Dar Jamail's new book, Military Resistors, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq, is due out shortly. You can read his reports at dahr.org. Dar Jamail currently writes for Interpress Service, Le Monde Diplomatique, and many other outlets. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. Write to us at talknationradio@gmail.com, and you can find us online at talknationradio.org.